Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the Art House Garage Podcast, the snob-free film show where we make art house, classic, and indie cinema accessible to the masses. We are keeping the classic film love going this week with another heavy hitter. Last time we talked about It Happened One Night. Coming up, we've got All About Eve, we've got Citizen Kane, but today, my guest Rance Collins and I dig into one of the best movies ever made, Casablanca. If you are wanting to learn more about classic cinema, this episode is perfect for you. We go deep into the movie's meaning, context, and legacy, and Rance brings some fascinating historical knowledge about the film. More on that in a second, but first, a brief word to the Arkansas listeners. If you live in the Natural State and love movies, attention, there are a few really exciting events on the way. Coming up at the end of this month is the 3rd annual Hot Springs International Women's Film Festival on March 28th and 29th. It's at the historic Central Theater in downtown Hot Springs, and all of the films at this festival are by women filmmakers. It's no secret that women have been sidelined in the film industry for ever, literally since film existed, and so a festival like this is huge in making sure more voices are heard. I'm very much looking forward to attending this one. By the time the next episode of this podcast comes out, there should be a lineup announced online, so I'll make sure to check in again next time, give a brief rundown of what's coming at that festival. More information is at hotspringswomensfilmfestival.com. There are two other exciting events coming up specifically for women as well. One is a directing workshop hosted by Women in Film Arkansas on March 7th, so that's coming up quick. If you are a female director, this is for you. It's taking place at the Fletcher Library in Little Rock, and you can find more information on their website, womeninfilmarkansas.org, and on their Facebook page. And the other is the second annual Filmmaking Lab for Teen Girls from the Arkansas Cinema Society. If you are a teen girl and you want to be a filmmaker, this is for you. This is an incredible program that gets teenagers behind the camera and writing scripts and designing costumes and doing all of the film production. Last year, the shorts they produced premiered at ACS's Filmland Festival, and it was a very memorable evening. The Filmmaking Lab isn't until July, but I wanted to go ahead and mention it because applications are due March 31st. If you're a teen girl or you know a teen girl who should be involved, more information is at arkansascinemasociety.org. Sign up, it's an incredible thing. I just love that the Arkansas film community is doing so much to champion women. I think that's great. One other upcoming festival that I need to mention is the fantastic Made in Arkansas Film Festival, which is coming up on its second year. I got to go last year, and it's a really fun event, a lively crowd, a really diverse set of films. This is May 14th through 16th, so it's still a couple months away, but I wanted to mention it now because they are still taking submissions until April 24th. So if you have a short film, or you can make one by then, or a feature-length film, any genre, Made in Arkansas, find more information at madeinark.org. That's madeinark.org. I'm really excited that festival season is coming and there's so much going on in our state. If you want even more, subscribe to the monthly email at arthousegarage.com/subscribe for more events plus streaming recommendations from yours truly. Okay, let's move on to the main event, Casablanca. This is a big one. Depending on who you ask, this is the best movie ever made. Again, if you're relatively new to watching classic movies, you're about to learn a lot. If you have seen Casablanca 100 times, you still may learn something in this episode. Rance brings a ton of historical context about the production and the filmmakers and the actors involved, and it's really fascinating. If you've never seen it, Casablanca is set during World War II, and it follows the journey of Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart. He's a cynical and angry man who owns the hottest nightclub in town. The town is full of refugees from the war, and Rick's club is something of a cultural hub. Lots of shady business dealings going on there. It's also a neutral ground, so opposing French and German soldiers are occupying the same space, which is very interesting. Things take a turn when the stunning Ilsa turns up, played by Ingrid Bergman, and it turns out these two know each other, and we begin to understand why Rick is so cynical and angry. Those are the basics. There's a lot more going on. There's political intrigue. There's romance. And this movie has it all. Rance and I are going to go into a lot more depth. If you have never seen Casablanca, this can be a really great primer for why it's such a big deal, and I think this will make you want to go see it. But also be aware that we are going to give a spoiler warning towards the end. about three-fourths of the way through, because the ending of this movie is a huge deal in movie history. We couldn't not talk about it. So you can listen once you get to that three-fourths mark. We are going to give a spoiler warning before we get into the end of that movie. This is one that I would love for you to see without the expectation of what's going to happen at the end, because the ending is great. Also, just go watch it. It's amazing. It's famous for a reason. An incredible, incredible movie. All right, let's get to it. Here is myself and Rance Collins discussing the 1942 classic Casablanca.
Play it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply.
Well, you can't get away.
Don't hide me. Do something. You must help me.
I'd stick my neck out for nobody.
Wise foreign policy.
And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you
why did you come back? To tell me why you ran out on me at the railway station?
Yes.
And you can tell me now. I'm reasonably sober.
Welcome back again, Rance Collins, to Arthouse Garage. How are you today?
So good. So good to be back with you.
Yes, you too. And thanks for being here for all these classic film discussions. Today, we are talking about an incredible movie called Casablanca. How many times have you seen Casablanca?
I would guess around 10. I watched it for the first time when I was in high school. It was one of those movies that my dad like sat me down and said, you gotta see this one.
Yeah.
And I loved it the first time I saw it. And then I know that at some point I watched it in college because I don't know if you remember Dr. Steve Phillips. Andrew and I went to the same college.
Yes.
Spoiler.
That is how interesting.
But he showed it in a gender communication class.
Interesting. What was the connection there?
I don't remember what his thought process was. But regardless, I saw it again then, and I think I had seen it another time between then, and then I don't know. And at some point I saw it. I've seen it, I think, three or four times on the big screen now.
Wow, yeah.
Including on Valentine's Day, I watched it. First time I had seen it in 35 millimeter, which was really cool. And a couple years ago, I think it was like 2013, but I saw it at the Chinese Theater.
Oh, cool.
In Hollywood. So I have seen it many times and know it like the back of my hand.
Well, perfect. Then you are the perfect person to watch to have on the podcast. I've seen this just two times now. Once, you know, just a few days ago, and then once in high school. The first time, I think we were texting earlier, and I mentioned I think I didn't really have an appreciation for the historical context at that point. So I was like, yeah, this seems good, but I didn't quite understand why everyone was so rapturous about it. But revisiting it, I really was blown away by it. And so I'm on board. This is an incredible movie now.
And yeah, you'll discover that it somehow only gets better the more you watch it, because it's a very rich film in terms of character, in terms of story. There's so many layers to it, and it is, I think, such a good example of how a great movie is kind of like the perfect recipe for a really grandiose dessert or something. You know, you have to put in, you know, you have to put in the baking soda, but you can't forget the salt, but you can't forget the butter, and you know, you have to put in all of the elements, and when you get them just right, even by accident, you can end up creating the perfect souffle. So
I think that's great. And then the by accident piece of that, so we're going to talk a little bit about the production of it, and some of this really just the stars aligned in ways that couldn't have been manufactured to make this such an incredible cultural touchstone. But let's get into the plot a little bit. So I'll let you dive into that.
I mean, I'll try to make it as simple as possible. It's kind of there's a lot going on in the movie, but essentially Casablanca in the context of the film, not in real life, I should mention. It's December 1941, right before Pearl Harbor. They make a very clear point of saying it's December 1941 at one point. Mm-hmm. And the Casablanca, which is in French Morocco, is an unoccupied territory, meaning that it's kind of neutral in World War II. The French are occupying it, but German soldiers can walk around and nobody can fight each other, basically, in the area. And this place is seen as a jumping off point for any refugees in Europe trying to get to America. Mm-hmm. And it's still very difficult to get there. A lot of people get stuck in Casablanca because they wait and they wait in order to get the money for the plane ticket, to get the letters of transit, mm-hmm. Which letters of transit are basically these documents that can guarantee your passage to the Americas. And at the beginning of the film, a man is captured and taken into custody because he supposedly has two letters of transit that are intended for a French resistance leader who is going to Casablanca to get to the Americas. Mm-hmm. And he and his his wife are going to escape to America. And he does indeed get captured and killed. But before that happens, he ends up giving those letters of transit to Humphrey Bogart, who runs a cafe called Rick's American Cafe.
He's sort of our hero here. Yeah.
He's our hero. And he hides those letters of transit inside of his piano player, Sam's piano. Mm-hmm. And his possession of those letters of transit, and then the connection that he has to the French resistance leader's wife, end up being the crux of the entire story.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good summation, I think. So it really sets up well that this is a very kind of multicultural town. There's a lot mm-hmm. of refugees, a lot of people trying to get out and struggling to do that. And then it also sets up that Rick's is this like cultural center, that when it first establishes this location, it just goes from table to table, and there's all kinds of like kind of shady business deals happening, and
accents, so yes, many accents, yeah, and languages,
types of people, yeah.
Which it should be noted that, contrary to what a lot of people, or what was probably customary at the time, where you just hire an actor and they pretend to be something, this movie does have a very multicultural mm-hmm. Cast.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people in the cast who are not from the United States, mm-hmm. Who have very prominent roles. Conrad Veidt, who plays the German major Strasser, mm-hmm. who is visiting Casablanca. He, I believe, was actually German. Mm. And so he's playing a Nazi in an anti-Nazi movie. Mm. He died not long after Casablanca, interestingly.
Mm. Wow.
And then you have Paul Henreid, who mm-hmm. plays the French resistance leader, Victor Laszlo, who was Austrian. So very, very close to the situation, had actually immigrated to the United States to escape World War II.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in his story, I should mention, I know his younger daughter, who is currently trying to work to get together a documentary called Beyond Victor Laszlo.
Oh, wow.
And her name's Monica Henreid, and she runs a Facebook group that's called Beyond Victor Laszlo. And then she runs a Instagram page called We Love Paul Henreid. So if you're interested in his career, he made quite a few movies for Warner Brothers. He was under contract to the studio at the time. And this is a Warner Brothers production. It is very much a Warner Brothers production because essentially everybody in the cast and crew, except for Ingrid Bergman, is a Warner Brothers contractee.
Okay.
You have Humphrey Bogart, who in the 1940s would be their biggest male star at the studio. Mm. You have their great They're a great roster of supporting actors, including Sidney Greenstreet, who plays the owner of the rifle club in town, the Blue Parrot. He is great. The guy who comes in with the letters of transit at the beginning of the movie is the lovely little sinister Peter Lorre.
Yes.
Who's always so a great...
He's such an interesting screen presence. He's kind of... I actually said this to a friend of mine after seeing... Actually, it was after watching The Maltese Falcon. I think it was on the previous episode of this podcast. He kind of reminds me of like Steve Buscemi-esque. Like, if that would be maybe a sort of a modern day equivalent.
That is a very good comparison.
Talk about those bulging so, eyes.
You know, he can be sinister or he can be sinisterly funny. Mm. It's a very, very interesting, very small man, very... seedy, but like in a really interesting way. Yeah. They got SC Suttles Cuddles Seagal, who is the chef at Rick's Cafe.
Oh, he's so
and
funny.
It's just like this. And then, of course, the guy who plays, oh shoot, I'm forgetting his name right now. The guy who plays Sam, the piano player.
Dooley Wilson.
Dooley Wilson, who is, you know, kind of like the commentator on everything that's going on.
Has a big personality himself too. Yeah.
Yes. It's just this great multicultural cast that really, in my opinion, gets that captures that camaraderie that comes through desperation and tough times and drives home what World War II must have felt like as a uniting force for the Allied powers.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, and then we can talk a little more about Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman and kind of their legacy. But so the movie, it takes place during World War II, as we mentioned, 1941, and was released... right before Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And it came out while the war was still going on. So it's
Very early.
Yeah,
actually,
pretty quickly after that period.
About a year after Pearl Harbor is when the movie was released.
Wow, that is really fast.
So it went into production less than 6 months before after Pearl Harbor. Yeah.
So when Paul Henreid's character Victor Laszlo shows up, you start to feel the political unrest a little bit in this. So it's a unique situation that there are the opposing forces, you know, in the same club at different tables right across the room from each other. And there's one, probably the most moving scene in the movie for me is a moment when a group of German soldiers have begun singing. You know, they're drinking and they're singing a German kind of...
A German patriotic song.
Yeah, yeah, something. And Paul Henreid, the resistance leader, tells the band to start playing... what's the name?
La Marseillaise.
La Marseillaise, yes. Which is like a French nationalism kind of song. And Rick says, yes, go for it. And like gives them the go-ahead. And it kind of drowns them out. And everyone that's French in the club, which is probably most of the people there...
And French sympathetic,
And French sympathizer. So, I mean, anti-Nazi, basically. Which is still something that, you know, we have to deal with today.
Unfortunately timely. Yeah.
Yeah. But they, you know, get swept up in it, and it's really an emotional scene in a way that would sound, it probably sounds cheesy saying it, just describing it, but it really, it's handled really well. And, and I just imagine how that must have hit an audience who was still in the midst of a war. Nazism was a very real threat to their everyday lives, and they're seeing this movie and their heroes kind of having this moment against it. I just can't imagine anything modern that could kind of do the same thing. It was really a potent kind of moment, and it has so much to do with the cultural context and the historical context that it was released in. It's pretty
amazing. For sure. I mean, World War II is such an interesting time period. It's always, this is not the only movie we'll be talking about that deals with World War II, actually. We will be getting to the best years of our lives a little bit later. But the thing that I find so interesting about World War II is I think it's one of the really few clear-cut cases in a war where you can go and say, okay, this side was bad, this side was good, you know, because it's just so blaringly obvious yeah. that you have to defeat the people who are killing millions of people mm-hmm. Because of their race or their religion. Mm-hmm. And it's to me always empowering to watch a movie from this period and see that goodness mm-hmm. in people, mm-hmm. you know? And Casablanca in a way is a patriotic film. And it mm-hmm. is a movie that could be seen as an effort to put out propaganda for the war. Mm-hmm. Because it does ultimately about sacrificing oneself for the good mm-hmm. Of your country, of the world. But it's done in such a way that is so stealth and yeah. so not beat you over the head moralistic mm-hmm. that it probably is far more successful than any other of the movies that were made during that period. Mm-hmm. And it's probably why it's held up
yeah.
so well.
Yeah, it doesn't get to any of that kind of stuff till pretty late in the film, I think at least halfway. Mm-hmm. And other than that, it's just kind of noticing everything and not really making any blatant arguments, I think, one way or the other.
Yeah.
But then I think you mentioned and I was going to say too, I think it probably works. It doesn't feel like it's beating you over the head because it's just such a great movie otherwise too. That's not the only thing going mm-hmm. for it. And so you mentioned the goodness and seeing that displayed so well. And that's a lot of what Humphrey Bogart's character arc is in this movie. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Humphrey Bogart and kind of his performance and then maybe introducing his other work to people if they're not familiar with him. But he plays Rick, as we mentioned. He's when we meet him, he's really kind of, I mean, Humphrey Bogart's famous for playing these kind of hard-boiled kind of
mm-hmm. embittered,
yeah, angry sort of characters. And that's very much the feeling when we see him. He actually one of my favorite things about this is just his banter. He has just these biting, sarcastic retorts to like Sidney Greenstreet's character in particular, and then when he's talking yeah. to like Peter Lorre as well, and he's just going back and forth in these kind of business dealing kind of conversations, and it's very, very funny. Mm-hmm. And he's just incredible to watch, and
he's incredible. It seems in the entire like first half hour of the movie where you're setting up this character, and ultimately, you know, you're heading to the real inciting incident, and that's mm-hmm. the entrance of Ingrid Bergman into yeah. the movie. Not the inciting incidents, mm-hmm. but the first, like the big catalyst of yeah, the story is so. Her coming in, and you're setting all of that up, and they do such a good job of establishing him as this really, as you said, hard-boiled person who is very sarcastic and sticks his neck out for nobody, mm-hmm. as he says. And they set all of that up, and you get it, you see it, you know that this is coming from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then when they show you what it came from, it's the first time you see his character break mm-hmm. at all.
Yeah.
And it's such an incredibly well-layered character and yeah. performance.
Yeah, it's all in the performance.
But, you know, yeah. I think that there's an analogy in his character, because so much about what we're watching is so embedded in World War II. And I think Rick's character is, in a lot of ways, he kind of represents the United States. Because he's keeping to himself. He's pretending like nothing's going on. He's being a pacifist, mm-hmm. if you will, not getting involved. He's been involved in fights in the past and gotten burned mm-hmm. and doesn't want to go back there, which is not unlike yeah. the U.S. position on World War II up until Pearl Harbor. Then Ingrid Bergman, or Pearl Harbor, happens.
A bomb gets dropped in his club, and in the form of Ingrid Bergman.
The bomb gets dropped in his club, and he has to decide whether or not he's going to join the fight.
Mm. Yeah.
Because now he's been hit straight on.
That's really good. That's a great analogy. I think, yeah, and I think too, so he has this such a strong persona. You do see his character break a little when she comes in, and then after she's mm-hmm. gone, he, you know, has this big moment where he's just drinking alone and like, wow, he's really going through something here. And then yeah. with the famous song, As Time Goes By, we have this flashback and he goes back and you realize, they were lovers, very involved. And that's why he's having such a hard time. And what's so amazing is in his performance, you see for the first time in this flashback that his countenance is completely different. He's very almost happy-go-lucky, which is just odd. He's in love, and it's just yeah. a totally different.
It's a totally different person.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's really amazing.
It's a brilliant performance, and mm-hmm. he's one of those people who I feel like, you know, he's so known for his persona that I think his skill can get overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because sometimes people are so good at playing a certain kind of character mm-hmm. that you don't notice the work that's going into it.
Yeah,
and mm-hmm. I think, you know, yeah, he kind of played a lot of variations on a similar type, you know, which mm-hmm. is, you know, true of a lot of movie stars. And his type has been parodied over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
But he has a depth to everything he's doing in this movie that it's not just this cardboard cutout. Mm-hmm. It's somebody who's been through some stuff. And you see that in every second of his performance.
Mm. Yeah. It's absolutely incredible. Well, if people aren't familiar with Humphrey Bogart, what are some of his other big movies?
Humphrey Bogart's a really great story because he was a kind of a late in life movie star. Mm. He was working mainly on Broadway in New York for a long time. He actually tried to make some movies in the early 30s and it didn't really go. He didn't get any leads. Mm. And then he had this play that he did in New York called The Petrified Forest, with an actor named Leslie Howard, who is best known for playing Ashley in Gone with the Wind.
Oh, okay.
And he would not make Petrified Forest if they didn't hire Humphrey Bogart to play the outlaw character that holds up this little convenience store in the middle of nowhere. It also has Betty Davis in it and a few others. It's a really great little movie.
Wow.
But that was a Warner Brothers film. They hired him as a contract player right after Petrified Forest did so well.
Wow.
And then they were dropping him in random movies, but they hadn't really figured out how to use him. And eventually they kind of put him in some gangster movies. And that was kind of working. And then he made, you know, he's like 40 plus now. He gets in a couple of movies right in the early 40s. High Sierra is one of them. Mm. And then Maltese Falcon. And that's what makes him a movie star. Wow, they finally figure out who he is and what he's good at. But there's some weird Humphrey Bogart stuff before that. Because there's another Betty Davis movie called Dark Victory, which is one of her big, like, nobody else in the movie matters. It's all her.
Hmm.
And Humphrey Bogart is in the movie and he plays this like Irish horse stable dude.
That sounds so odd.
And it doesn't make, and he doesn't fit the character at all. Wow. And it just like, he's not bad, but it's just like, you know, it's just like, well, this doesn't make any sense. You know, yeah. Ronald Reagan's in that movie too, by the way.
Wow.
Really weird cast. Reagan. They finally figure out who he is, and Casablanca is like right after he becomes box office.
Mm.
And it, I mean, like, he makes a lot of good movies after Casablanca, but I mean, it's the greatest movie. Yeah. So, you know,
yeah, nothing quite lives up to it. Yeah, but I've seen several others of his. I've seen, which is a little unusual for me in the classic film world. I still feel like I'm learning a lot, but I've seen Maltese Falcon, which there is actually a podcast episode from about a year ago that yep. I did with a friend. And then
John Huston.
Yep. The Big Sleep, I've seen that one as well. And Treasure of Sierra Madre. Yeah, actually,
highly recommend all four of the movies that he made with Lauren Bacall, who was his last wife, and they were together until he died in the late 50s. There's also To Have and Have Not, Key Largo, and I love a movie called Dark Passage that they did together. They have one of those great screen romances that turned real life. And he's in a great little Christmas movie called We Are No Angels. He won his Oscar for The African Queen, another John Huston movie, which is a solid film, but probably more famous for the fact that it was filmed on location in Africa and everybody got sick and almost died.
Yikes. A troubled production.
Yes.
I have actually, I just remembered he's in Sabrina as well. That's one that I've seen.
Oh, he's in the, with Audrey Hepburn.
Yes.
Much, much older than Audrey Hepburn, but he's in a he's in that movie with Audrey Hepburn and William Holden. You know, he remained a big box office star right up until when he died in 57. So, and he really, there's a great movie that he's in called In a Lonely Place. Oh, In a Lonely Place is amazing. It's like a great film noir. He plays a screenwriter who's kind of crazy, and it is really good.
Wow.
Yeah. Nicholas Ray did the movie. He's the one who directed Rebel Without a Cause.
Okay. Interesting.
So yeah, there's the sum total is there are any movie with Humphrey Bogart is going to at least be interesting because he's such an interesting screen presence.
Yes. So he's probably a good place to follow the thread and watch some more things. He's made a lot of good things. Well, then our other star, Ingrid Bergman, is amazing in this too, and so beautiful. What's her kind of legacy like in classic Hollywood?
She also oddly ended up in Hollywood not because of Leslie Howard, but Leslie Howard has a lot to do with her fame. Leslie Howard, as an actor, by the way, as I said, he played Ashley in Gone with the Wind. That's what most people know him from. But he was considered a very respected actor at the time, and he died in a plane crash in World War II.
Oh, wow.
When he was in action. So that kind of obviously stunted his career a little bit. But he wanted to produce, and David Selznick cut a deal with Leslie Howard that he would allow him to produce a movie that had been made in Sweden called Intermezzo. And he wanted to make the American version, and he wanted to make it with the same female star, Ingrid Bergman. And Selznick had just signed Ingrid Bergman to a contract because he thought she should make that movie over here, and Leslie Howard wanted to produce it and star in it. And so in order to get him to do Gone with the Wind, he let him do Intermezzo. And then that movie ended up making Ingrid Bergman a thing. And Casablanca was arguably her first really big success, although she was nominated that year for a different film. She was nominated for Whom the Bell Tolls, which that movie ends up, all of Casablanca is a happy accident. As time goes by is the famous song from that movie, but As Time Goes By wouldn't have happened had Ingrid Bergman not been filming for Whom the Bell Tolls, where she had to cut her hair really, really short. And as time goes by in editing, they were like, maybe we don't want this song after all. And so they were going to call Ingrid Bergman back to reshoot the scenes with a different song. But Ingrid Bergman had cut her hair.
And so they just couldn't do it.
And so they scrapped, cutting As Time Goes By just because they couldn't match Ingrid Bergman's look for the scenes.
Okay, I guess we'll be stuck with this timeless song that has now become, you know, synonymous with cinema.
Synonymous.
Yeah.
And is literally the song that you hear at the beginning of every Warner Brothers movie, because the Warner Brothers logo now, you know, the intertitle is always So you have Casablanca to thank for the Warner Brothers logo.
What a legacy that song
logo
is.
Music.
It's also the name of, there's a great film history podcast called You Must Remember This, which is of course a line from the song. And that's a great podcast.
Every episode starts with a little with Ingrid Bergman going, humming the song. And Ingrid Bergman, real quickly, Ingrid Bergman does have an interesting career. If you are interested in her stuff, she won 3 Academy Awards. She won for a movie called Gaslight, which is a fun little Hitchcockian psychological thriller. She also won for a very delightful version of Anastasia in the 50s, of the Anastasia story. And then she won supporting actress as one of a gazillion stars, including Lauren Bacall, in Murder on the Orient Express in the 70s. Sidney Lumet's version of that movie. And that is not to say anything negative about Kenneth Branagh, but it is Sidney Lumet's version of the movie with Albert Finney is superior. But Ingrid Bergman, you know, she also worked with the Italian director Roberto Rossellini, who ended up being someone she had an affair with and married, which made her box office poison because America didn't forgive her for a little while. How times have changed. That, of course, gave us Isabella Rossellini, who made Blue Velvet with David Lynch.
Wow, I never made that connection. Wow.
Yeah, there you go. And she, her mom's Ingrid, and she is hilarious in a movie called Death Becomes Her.
A few other Hitchcock things I'm seeing on her page, too.
Ingrid also was in 3 Hitchcock movies, most significantly a film called Notorious, which is pretty perfect. So, there's a lot with Ingrid.
Speaking of family legacy, so no relation to Ingmar Bergman, the director, correct?
No, although they did work together in a movie called Autumn Sonata, which was her last Oscar nomination.
Wow, I never put that together. Yeah, it just happened to, they're both Swedish, so I guess
they're both Swedish.
Just a Swedish surname.
Same last name, but not related. Although 23andMe didn't exist yet, maybe.
You never know. if only they had that at that time. Speaking of the director, let's talk about the director of this movie, Michael Curtiz. What else has he made? What's his legacy?
He is someone you might call like a studio workhorse. He was under contract to Warner Brothers for a really long time. He went over to Paramount after that. And he was basically just assigned a lot of different random projects, and he knocked all of them out of the park. He was a very reliably great director with a really great visual eye. He was Hungarian, so English was not his first language. So he was much more a visual director, which is so interesting because the dialogue is so on point throughout the entire film.
That is interesting. It's also visually really great. There's a lot of really good shadow moments and close-up moments, and
He was known for his use of shadow in a lot of films too, because he made the movie The Adventures of Robin Hood, and the most famous scene, there's a couple famous scenes in that movie, but I would say the one that people would probably most recognize is this sword fight that happens at the end of the film, where there's giant shadows of Robin Hood and who's the bad guy in Robin Hood? It's the same in every story.
I'm blanking. What, Prince John? Yes,
Prince John. Yeah. When it's Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone are doing a sword fight in the castle, and they're going down the steps, and there's a big shadow on the wall. Like, that is the big visual thing from that movie. That one's in Technicolor, though. And by the way, if you are interested in Michael Curtiz, start at The Adventures of Robin Hood. It's so much fun. It is a great version of that story. And it's one of the best uses of color ever in a film. And then he also, speaking of colorful movies, he did the all-time Christmas classic, White Christmas.
Yes.
Indeed, he did an Elvis movie that's actually good called King Creole. one of the few dramatic roles from Elvis that makes you wonder what his career would have been like had they not shoved him in a bunch of cheap musicals.
He did a movie called Francis of Assisi, I'm seeing on here, who I don't know anything about that, but I'm interested in St. Francis in his life, so I'll have to check that out.
Well, he made a lot of movies. He basically worked multiple times with everybody you could imagine who was under contract at Warner Brothers. multiple Errol Flynn movies, Bette Davis movies. Bette Davis hated him, but they made a few movies together. Hmm. he was just about the best studio workout horse director you could ask for. Hmm. And he could do any genre. He could do anything. So yeah, that's him. So there's also somebody else we need to talk about who we haven't talked about yet.
Let's hear it.
Claude Rains.
Yes, Claude Rains. He plays Captain Renault. Yeah, we haven't mentioned him at all. He is the sort of the police chief of Casablanca. Mm-hmm. So he has
he's French in the even though he does not speak with a French accent.
He has a pretty high status in town, and he's one of the people who kind of controls the visa papers and uses his power. He's an interesting man because it's hard to read whether he's good or bad, kind of. And you see him doing some pretty bad things, but I also see some kind of good things from him. He lords his visa powers over vulnerable women, basically, and exploits them.
Promises them passage to America if they will, it is implied, sleep with them.
Yeah.
So.
On the other hand, he is, you see him doing some kind things and helping people out and helping Humphrey Bogart out in different situations. He's a very interesting character. You never know quite what to expect from him.
And he plays, it's a character that could very easily just be very unsympathetic,
mm-hmm.
Because he's very slimy. But because Claude Rains is so charming,
mm-hmm.
in a weird way, he's able to get away with being a sleazeball.
Yeah.
And he plays it in a way that towards the end of the movie, when he has, a bit of a change of heart, it's very believable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure.
And you needed the right kind of performer in that part. Otherwise, that would not have come off.
Mm-hmm.
And Claude Rains has a very long and interesting career. He was never like a big star leading man type, but he is just in so many great movies and he's always astounding in them. He's in Lawrence of Arabia, one of his mm-hmm. last films. He's in Notorious, which I mentioned a second ago. He's the main bad guy in the movie Notorious with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. And that is, he was nominated for an Oscar for that movie, as he was Casablanca, because it's just a great, great performance. There's a Michael Curtiz film where he plays the patriarch of this, of four daughters, and the movie is called Four Daughters. and it's just a really sweet little family movie. He's also in Ronald Reagan's most famous film, a movie called King's Row. There are no famous Ronald Reagan movies, I should preface. He became a bigger star retroactively. Mm-hmm. But he is in this movie called King's Row, where the big thing that happens is he gets his legs amputated in the film.
Wow.
And Claude Rains is kind of this like weird doctor in the movie. He exits pretty quickly, but it's very interesting. Hmm. Ronald Reagan has the line, "Where's the rest of me?"
Wow.
Which ended up being the title of his autobiography. So, I mean,
wow.
there's your through line. Yeah, but Claude Rains is always perfect in every movie he's in. He's also in a movie that came out this year, and by this year I mean 1942, called Now Voyager, that was filmed back to back with Casablanca. They even share a train station set.
Wow.
And they share a composer. Max Steiner did both movies. Paul Henreid is the male lead in the movie. Claude Rains is another one of the leads in the movie. Bette Davis, that's a Bette Davis tearjerker basically, but it is also another great example of a great Warner Brothers movies. Warner Brothers, it was a factory, you know, they plugged in all these people and sometimes, that accidentally turned into magic.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, it certainly hit hard in Casablanca. Well, let me see. Should we go ahead and let's go ahead and jump into the story's ending, because it's one of the most famous scenes in the movie and in movie history. So I feel like we should talk about it. So if you have not seen it, we are going to get into some spoilers right now. I would recommend pausing and going to watch it because it really is amazing. And having that experience the first time, I think, is important. So
I mean, like, it's also on the AFI 2007 top 100 list, it's number 3.
Yeah.
So I mean,
we're not the only people who think this is a good movie.
you need to get on this.
Yes, it's a heavy hitter. Okay, well, spoiler warning out of the way. Explain the ending for us, Rance.
Okay, so the movie all leads to Rick, Humphrey Bogart's character, deciding that he's going to do the right thing, which is give the letters of transit to Ingrid Bergman and Paul Henreid so that Paul Henreid can continue his work with the French resistance over in America and take down the Nazis. But in the process of getting there, he's convinced he and Ingrid Bergman kind of fall back in love, and she thinks that, you know, he's going to send off Paul Henreid and she'll stay behind with him. And then he tells Claude Rains that he's going to go off on the plane with Ingrid Bergman on his own and leave Paul Henreid to be captured by the Nazis. Like, there's...
Yeah, so everyone in the situation thinks it's going to happen a different way. And then we, as the audience, are waiting for what's actually going to happen. And it also...
But Humphrey Bogart's real plan is to send Paul Henreid off with Ingrid Bergman. He knows that his character needs his wife by his side in order to have that inspiration to keep going. And he knows that if she stays with him, she might die. Mm. So he's saving her life. He's saving his life. He ends up doing the right thing. And basically, Paul Henreid says it at the end of the movie. He says, welcome back to the fight. This time I know we'll win, which is amazing, because they didn't know they were going to win. They didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're just hoping at that point, you know. Wow.
Again, and just imagining seeing that in 1941 or 1942 is incredible. But
yeah, no. And then, of course, there ends up being a scene just between Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart at the airport where she's protesting. She doesn't want to go. And he gives the most epic, wonderful speech, explaining why she has to, explaining why they can't be together, and explaining why the last 48 hours have brought back Paris, where they fell in love. We'll always have Paris, being Glynne. He says, here's looking at you, kid. And he says, the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. He basically just rattles off quote after quote after quote that we'll hear parodied for years to come.
Gold just coming out of his mouth.
And there's these incredible close-ups of both of them that have that perfect black and white misty quality. And nice the glow. Set is this fog-shrouded airport that was actually inside of a soundstage at Warner Brothers. They used a miniature airplane in the background, and they used little people to man that airplane so it looked like it was bigger and farther away.
Which is such an interesting detail that I'm going to have to go back and rewatch that scene just to realize that now, because I learned that after seeing it. I was like, oh my gosh. Well, anyway.
But you're so swept up in the story by that point that even if there is a moment that makes where it's obvious that it's not a real plane, you're not even there, because you're so involved in what's going to happen to those three little people, you know? And then of course, Claude Rains's character, he ends up, Louis, he ends up, switching over to the right side of history, and that leads to him saying the line, round up the usual suspects. There's just so many quotes that happen in the last 5 minutes of this movie. It's a little and then the very last line of the film, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, you know.
It's embarrassing how many incredible lines are in this short period of time.
Again, there was never a final script. The whole time they were shooting, it's all an accident.
It's incredible. the way that kind of final moment plays out, so that they're about to fly away, the plane's on the way out, and then the German Major Strasser shows up, and it's like, oh no, he's going to ruin everything. And then Humphrey Bogart pulls a gun on him and says, if you call the radio tower, I'm going to shoot you. And there hasn't been anything violent so far in the movie. Like, there's been the presence of a gun a few times, but
nobody's been shot.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, that's not going to happen probably. And then he keeps going and he shoots him and he's dead. And then the thing that Claude Rains does to redeem himself essentially is he covers for him by saying, yeah, round up the usual suspects and we're gonna pretend we don't know that Rick did this. And
it's inspiring. It like really shows like man, you know, when the chips get down, we're gonna be there for each other. Mm. You know, it sends out such a powerful message in a really subtle way.
Yeah. It also sets up Rick to be in the perfect situation to do all the wrong things, and yet he still comes through, and I think that's really great too.
Yeah, I mean, he could very easily, in this scenario, he could very easily just go off with the girl he loves.
Yeah, he's got Ilsa back,
and he could have set it up to where, you know, he could have sacrificed Victor Laszlo so that he could have. And thrown him to the Nazis, and Ingrid Bergman might have not even been the wiser to the fact that he was doing that.
It's essentially like,
but he,
the love of your life or the Nazis win. Like, make the choice.
Yeah,
which is quite a setup, but it's believable and it really, really works. But
yeah, and it's just remarkable that this comes out, you know, so a year after when it supposedly takes place, and we don't know the outcome of the war. And yet, here we have this incredibly hopeful, patriotic film. The war is still raging. It's not even to its height yet overseas. And this movie comes out. It comes out right at the end of 1942. So close to the end of 42 does it premiere that it actually doesn't even qualify for the 1942 Oscars. And so well received was the film that it was still in the minds of voters when the 1943 Oscars came along. And even, you know, over a year after it was released or premiered, I should say, it still ended up winning Best Picture, Best Director.
Which doesn't really happen.
Probably should have been Best Actor, but, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. He was nominated at least. And then Claude Rains was nominated as well for supporting. But you mentioned earlier, no Ingrid Bergman. She was nominated for something else that year.
Yeah, I know the people who won in those categories, and I understand their wins. Mm. So it's difficult for me to argue about it. Humphrey Bogart does eventually get an Oscar, so that helps. Claude Rains doesn't, which is a bit of a bummer, but he is, the performance he lost against is almost a leading performance. It's Charles Coburn in a movie called The More the Merrier, which is delightful, by the way, if you ever want to watch a great little romantic comedy. Right. And he plays a matchmaker between these two people in the film. It's another wartime movie as well. But
the Casablanca wins for Best Picture and Best Director and Best Screenplay.
Which, I mean, you know, it probably should have won cinematography too, but it's okay. I mean, like,
we're not mad. We're not bitter.
Or the score is perfect. Like, I mean, like, it's literally one of those movies where every element is just dead on, you know?
Yeah. I think that's, you know, the legacy, it comes from that. Like, it's on the filmmaking side, it's firing on all cylinders, actors, the screenplay, the music, but then also having that cultural potency and hitting the zeitgeist in that way. I think.
And you think about how many times, you know, they get together every single heavy hitter in movies, and you got the Spielberg directing, and you got the biggest movie stars, and you got John Williams. You know, you get all the different parts and pieces, and yet so rarely does that, that will often yield a good movie, but does it yield the greatest movie when they intentionally try to put the greatest movie ever together? A lot of times not, but for whatever reason, this movie, which was pumped out in a series of a lot of other movies being pumped out, ends up being perfect.
Yeah, my goodness. You know? The stars aligned. You can't
it's
replicate
just sometimes
it.
Sometimes it just happens. It's just lightning in the bottle.
Amazing.
You know?
Do you have any other...
Go ahead. Well, I know you really enjoyed the Bugs Bunny connection with It Happened One Night, and there is a Looney Tunes parody, of course, because it's a Warner Brothers property. There's
That's
a Looney
what I was
Tunes.
Ask, actually, what legacy and what parodies do you know of for this one?
Well, there's Carol Blanca, which is the Looney Tunes parody. Actually, I think it came out in like the 90s. It was a lot later, but it's really funny. There's been Casablanca parodies left and right, of course. The dialogue is often referenced in other movies and TV shows, but there's also, I mean, like, I know when I was growing up, I remember the episode of Boy Meets World that there's an episode, I think it's in the last season. It's after Corey and Topanga get married. Spoiler, Corey and Topanga end up getting married in the last
Boy
season
Meets World
of Boy Meets World.
Spoilers. I have to put a Boy Meets World spoiler alert on the podcast notes.
I mean, like, Corey, the last few seasons of Boy Meets World really beats you over the head with Corey and Topanga are destined to be together.
Yeah.
So, which, not complaining, I totally shipped them, don't get me wrong. But watched it every Friday night on TGIF.
There you go.
But they had an episode where, like, Topanga is like clearing out their closet and she discovers this time traveling thing in their closet and falls into it. And she's in like this Rick's Cafe black and white situation. And all the characters are playing send ups of Casablanca characters.
That sounds amazing.
I'm sure it was cheesy as can be, but I really enjoyed it at the time, and I hadn't even seen Casablanca yet. So,
there you go. The one that I grew up with always seeing was a movie called a screwball comedy called What's Up, Doc? With Barbara Streisand. And there's a big scene where I'd heard the song and heard some of these lines before I'd ever seen the movie, but she is wooing Ryan O'Neal and almost like psychotically chasing him.
Not almost, it's pretty psychotic. She's a little borderline the whole movie.
Yes, absolutely.
By borderline I mean borderline personality disorder.
That's true. They sing as time goes by on the piano. She does a Humphrey Bogart impression, kind of. She's doing this quirky cutesy thing the whole time, which, you know, so you kind of skirt over the fact that she's like potentially ruining people's lives with her antics, but it's also just really funny.
No, I mean, I will say that if you ever need a jumping off point for Barbara Streisand, that's a great point.
It's a perfect one.
What's Up, Doc? Is also Peter Bogdanovich is a huge film fan, and he's the guy who directed that movie. And so, What's Up, Doc? Was very intentionally supposed to be embedded with tons and tons of film references because he was a huge film fan.
It's so funny. It's got a great chase scene all across San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It's very zany and just really
it's a great
silly
sightseeing.
Yeah,
you see a lot of famous San Francisco locations in that film. Ryan O'Neal is the, and then it's also Madeline Kahn's first movie, which she's one of the funniest. Right.
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I've seen it like 10 times probably, but I remember realizing it was introducing Madeline Kahn. It was her first thing. Yeah,
I know. Wow. I mean, like, without What's Up, Doc, do we have Blazing Saddles? Do we have Young Frankenstein? Do we have Clue? I mean,
I don't want to
we
imagine
probably,
such a world.
I don't even, I mean, like, what would we do without the gif of Madeline Kahn saying flames, flames, flames on the side of my face? I said without inflection, but I hope you know where that's from. Mrs. White, I think, is the character she plays in Clue. Anyway.
Yes, I just watched that actually for the first time about a month ago.
I only saw it for the first... I knew some of the quotes because people... Seen, you know, it's one of those movies that is referenced, but I saw it for the first time like a year ago, and it's great.
It's so funny.
It's really funny. and great cast, too. Like, absolutely. Anyway, and then of course the number of quotable lines in this movie have led to.
I was going to say, do you have any other favorite quotes?
Well, there's a Woody Allen movie called Play It Again, Sam, which is a reference to a line in this movie that is misquoted in part because of a movie being called Play It Again, Sam. that's really Play It, Sam. Mm. And you played it for her, you can play it for me. And they're talking about As Time Goes By being the big song of the film. And of course, As Time Goes By is one of those, I think it was ranked like, I think it's ranked number 2 on the AFI's movie song list. Mm.
What's number 1?
Over the Rainbow is number 1.
Makes sense.
I mean, come on. You could, if you had thought about that for a couple of seconds, I think you would have gotten it.
Yeah, I probably would have guessed that one.
Yeah. Although, you know, What's Up Talk is on that list too.
Really?
What it's song on that. I don't think I'm making this up, but the You're the Top. The
yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah. I hope I didn't make that up. I feel like that's a thing.
I'll fact check it in the show notes.
Yeah, this movie, the reverberations in popular culture are just all over the place.
Yeah. And then one of the other lines that, and this is one that Barbra Streisand says in What's Up Doc, is of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine, which is a great, when he's first going through his anguish of seeing her again after all these years.
Yeah. Such a great line. I'm wrong about What's Up Dog. This song is not on the... I'm very sorry to everyone. It should be. I mean, it was already in popular culture. She just covered it. It's fine. But anyway, that is one of the great lines. Round up the usual suspects. Of course, we'll always have Paris. Here's looking at you, kid. It's just like again and again and again.
Yeah.
Every line. Just ends up being remarkably quotable.
It's also really funny. There's some really funny quotes. Some of them are actually, so one that I stuck out to me is a kind of, it's just showing his worldview at the beginning. And he's, you know, so yeah, I stick my neck out for no one. He says, that's another quote he says a lot. But then there's a line about these two German soldiers who have recently died. It's been in the news in Casablanca, and it's sort of related to all the intrigue that's happening with the papers. I can't remember the exact line, but he says, let me see if I can find it really quick, because it is a good line.
Oh, it is a good line. I know which one you're talking about. It's towards the beginning.
Yeah, so he's talking to Peter Lorre. Here it is. He says, too bad about those two German couriers, wasn't it? And Rick says, they got a lucky break. Yesterday, they were just two German clerks. Today, they're the honored dead. And, which, yeah, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Damn
that
Rick.
Hits you.
But yeah, so it shows his worldview, and also, you know, it sets, that's one of the earlier moments where you realize like this movie is going to go there politically and say like, yeah, maybe these Nazi soldiers are better off, you know, as honored dead than still in the world doing what they're doing. But yes, an interesting line, and so much of the again, like Rick talking to Ugarte, who's Peter Lorre, and talking to Sidney Greenstreet. It's just incredibly fast-paced, incredibly funny, incredibly just watchable. I could watch that stuff all day. I think the way he rattles those lines off is really great. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's just screenplay matching person matching everything. It's one of the greatest movies ever made.
I completely agree. Well, you are someone who's seen a lot of old movies. Do you think this is the greatest movie ever made?
You know, I think I want to quantify that there is a difference between the greatest movie ever made and your personal favorite film.
Mm. Yes.
But I think of those as two separate things.
Two different questions, yeah.
Casablanca is one of my favorite movies. It would be in my personal top 10. But if I was looking at all the movies ever made and I had to point to the one that I think is the best, I would say Casablanca.
There you have it. Best movie ever made. So don't skip Casablanca. It is absolutely worth your time. There you go. Well, I think that can kind of wraps up. Do you have any final thoughts on Casablanca?
You know, Casablanca is, to sum it all up, it is what I think we think of when we think of the movies. Hmm. This is a movie that has humor, suspense, has the gravity of real life world implications. It has a great romance at the center of it. It has quotable dialogue, memorable images, appealing stars who are gorgeous and yet relatable, and an amazing atmosphere that somehow in this club in Casablanca with this multicultural cast of characters, you're able to capture the desperation, the hope, the patriotism, and the fear that was driving the entire world during the early 1940s. It is a time capsule, and it is what a movie is supposed to be.
Beautifully put, and I think that's a perfect place to end. Thank you again, Rance, for joining us, and we will have you back again in a couple of weeks. Next time, we are going to talk about the movie All About Eve, which I've never seen.
Ah, so excited.
Excited to dig into that one. So good. And yeah, so join us for that, listeners, and we will say goodbye to Rance. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I will see you all next time.
It's still the same. It's perhaps a strange circumstance. We both should be in love with the same woman.
A case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
He's looking at you, kid.
That is all for this episode. Once again, big, big thanks to Rance. He is proving so valuable to this podcast series. Thank you for joining us, Rance. Be sure to tune in next time for a discussion of All About Eve. This is a Bette Davis movie that I have never seen, so I'm excited to dig into this one very soon. If you like what you hear, rate and review us on iTunes or whatever podcast app you are on. That goes a really long way. And you can follow us, Arthouse Garage, at Arthouse Garage on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd. You can email me, Andrew, at arthousegarage.com if you have comments or concerns, and you can read reviews of new movies at arthousegarage.com. Thanks so much for listening, and till next time, keep it snob free.